From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how you can ensure the money you give to charitable causes is really making the difference you hope.
Later, contributor Dave Kozlowski explains how climate change and agriculture are interrelated.
Anything we grow and process and transport is going to provide greenhouse gases. It doesn't matter whether it's a carrot or a quarter pounder. So there's some climate change impact in food production, period.
And writer and police sergeant Adam Plantiga talks about the difference he sees between cops and just plain police officers.
I think cops are just more sort of plugged in and in tune to the street. And that's why they're so valuable.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. How often are you stopped on the street by someone asking for a donation to a charitable cause? And nearly all of us have been bombarded by phone calls or email solicitations asking for our support. As the world has become more interconnected, we've been exposed to more giving opportunities than ever before. But how can we ensure that our limited dollars are going to the right place?
That's a question that writer Phil Buchanan has been working on for years. Buchanan is the founding chief executive of the Center for Effective Philanthropy and author of the new book, Giving Done Right. We reached him on the line recently. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
How much thought do you think the average person gives to the organizations to which they give?
That's a great question. I can't say that I know for sure, but probably not enough. And people tend to be very responsive to requests rather than thinking, well, what do I want to accomplish? And really trying to concentrate the bulk of their giving on pursuing their goals rather than whatever sort of emotional appeal got to them in the moment.
I know you're right about the classic case of the college student who shows up on your doorstep with potentially what might be a really good cause, and there's a lot of pressure in the moment to make a contribution, and we've all done that. But there are some reasons to say no at that moment.
Yeah, I think you want to be able to look back at the end of the year and say, well, I gave to organizations pursuing goals that are really important to me. Rather than I gave in response to whoever happened to ask me. It takes discipline, you know, and it's tough, but it can be done. And particularly, you know, one of the things I suggest is, you know, be realistic. You are sometimes going to give when your niece is asking you about her school project and it has to do with raising money for a nonprofit and you want to support her, even though the issue may not be particularly near and dear to your heart. But try to limit that kind of responsive or relational giving to 20% and have the 80% really be focused on what you care about.
So what were the critical questions that got you started in this field?
Well, I was really interested in, I've spent the last 18 years working with large institutional foundations and individual donors behind them. And I was interested in this question of how do you create the most impact with this tremendous amount of resources that people sometimes rather unexpectedly find themselves, with control over. And how do you do that, particularly when it is so difficult to assess results in philanthropy? People often analogize giving to investing, but in fact, it's a whole different kind of discipline, philanthropy, because measures are so elusive. There's no sort of analog to return on investment where I could say, oh, gee, I got, you know, 7 impact units for each dollar here and 5 here. You know, it's not like that. It's hard to know what progress looks like. It's hard to measure results, and yet it's so important to try to give effectively. And so I was interested in all of those challenges, and that's what I've spent, you know, the bulk of my career working on.
Well, and you make the point in a couple of places in this book that there are people out there who make this argument that, well, you know, nonprofits really ought to be run more like businesses. What's the fundamental flaw in that demand?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple. The first is that it's a meaningless phrase. What does it mean to run like a business? Is that like your neighborhood dry cleaner or Google or Apple? You know, like business, I think people mean effectively, but as Jim Collins, the business guru, often says, most businesses are mediocre. And if you think about, you know, your last couple of interactions with businesses, you'd probably agree. And so the question shouldn't be, you know, how do we run nonprofits like business? It should be, you know, how do we run nonprofits effectively to deliver results? And I believe that leading a nonprofit is actually significantly more challenging than leading an equivalent size business, because after all, nonprofits are working on the toughest challenges that have defied market solutions. So one of the things I try to do in the book is tell the story of nonprofit staff, nonprofit leaders working on the front lines in communities, helping folks, you know, sometimes whose lives are in jeopardy, and to really make the argument that these folks working at nonprofits are unsung American heroes, and they are doing tremendous work. They're usually not highly paid, and we need to recognize and support this fabric of our society. Nonprofits have touched almost all of our lives. They employ 1 in 10 Americans, and yet, what we often hear when we hear about nonprofits is stories of dysfunction or the occasional scandal of outrageous executive pay, but that's not really what the sector is. And part of what I'm trying to do is educate donors so they understand better the great strength in nonprofits in this country.
So if one way of evaluating the effectiveness or the strength of a nonprofit is by exploring its leadership, what should you look for? What should nonprofits look for? What should givers look for in how they see leadership at a nonprofit?
Yeah, I mean, I think they should look for folks who can really honestly answer three important questions that every nonprofit leader should be able to answer, which is, you know, what are you trying to do? What are you working on? What are your goals? Those are all kind of several ways of asking the same question. How are you doing it? So what are your strategies? What are your approaches? And then what information do you gather that lets you know whether things are working, and how do you respond to that information in order to learn and improve? And, you know, these are simple questions. You should be able to get answers in a conversation with a nonprofit leader. You should be able to get answers on a website of a nonprofit to those questions that are convincing and clear, and also candid about where things haven't worked. So that's what I would tell people to look for, and it's easier to find in some cases than others. But and it gets back to the measurement point that I made earlier, because you aren't going to be able to just look at something as tempting as it is, like the websites that rate nonprofits on things like percentage spent on overhead, which is not a helpful measure, because oftentimes overhead, depending on how it's defined, can be key to an organization's success if it means paying people what you need to pay them in order to retain, you know, the great staff to do the work, or investing in technology or so on. So really what you want to look at is leaders who can talk about the results that their organization's achieving and how they're achieving.
We talked about this myth, as you would say, that running a nonprofit, quote, like a business is what they should be shooting for. How is the increase in what are called, I guess, low profit liability companies impacting what nonprofits are able to do today?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's wonderful when there are hybrid, organizations like the ones that you described that are able to align, you know, pursuit of profit with pursuit of impact. I think that the hype about those social enterprises.
And we're talking about, these are companies like Patagonia, like Tom's, like a variety of companies that, you know, that support causes while also turning a profit.
Exactly. And that's great when it can be done and when everything aligns. And I think it often doesn't align, right? And so that there are many issues that folks work on where there isn't an opportunity to make a profit while simultaneously doing good. And I think we've fallen victim a little bit in this country in the last couple of decades to this sort of notion that, like, markets can solve all our problems and there kind of, there are no trade-offs. You know, I always say it's like that old SNL skit. If this will update myself, you know, it's a it's a floor wax and a dessert box. You know, some things just don't go together. And so if you're trying to help, you know, homeless kids get access to a good preschool education, there's no way to simultaneously, you know, make money. And we shouldn't be trying to do that. Sometimes philanthropy is what is needed to take on the issues that markets can't or that are a result of market failure. And so I'm all for, you know, social enterprises, whatever we want to call them, B Corps, but not the hype that has sometimes made it seem like, oh, we don't even need nonprofits anymore because we're going to be able to do everything in this new form. That's just a flat-out myth, and we need to be sober about the limits of markets.
I will, by the way, admit to being old enough to recognize that SNL reference.
Okay, all right. I appreciate that, yeah.
There's also something interesting, a point you make down the road about metrics and the nonprofit's ability to assess how well they are doing, and that is that one of the reasons they need support from people is to be able to do just that.
Absolutely. I mean, again, there's so many unfortunate and inaccurate myths about nonprofit leaders, and one of them is that, you know, they don't really care about performance assessment and metrics. And, you know, we have, at the Center for Effective Philanthropy, surveyed tens of thousands of nonprofit leaders, literally. And I have spent a lot of time shadowing nonprofit leaders as I worked on the book and since and before. And that's just not true. It's a question of resources. And oftentimes, you know, major donors will say, we need to see these metrics and those metrics, and we want you to report on this and that. And the nonprofit says, well, yeah, you know, that's great. Are you going to pay for that? Are you going to support us in doing that? And also, another point is the conversation should really be about what the nonprofits need in order to assess and improve, just not just what the funders want to know. And it should be like an interaction where there's agreement on, okay, given our shared goals, the donors and the nonprofits, what are the things that we want to look at to see if we're making progress? And that is really important because we have seen too many examples in this country of things that get funded that don't work or have the opposite of the intended effect. They sound like they would work, like Scared Straight is a good one, in the sense that it's a really vivid example of this situation in which folks keep funding something, even though evaluation after evaluation shows that the program in which formerly incarcerated people come and talk to, you know, high school students about how you shouldn't pursue a life of crime actually had the opposite of the intended effect. Attitudes about crime became more positive, moved in the wrong direction after the program. And there's evaluation after evaluation, and yet folks continue to fund it and support it. That happens too often. So we really do need to focus on measures, focus on evidence and data, but we need to do it in a thoughtful way and in a way that supports nonprofits to do that work, because that work isn't free.
Well, what about novel ways of giving? Things like, you know, you write about giving circles. Where do they enter the dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, giving circles have grown so rapidly in the last decade, and I think it's really fantastic because it suggests that, you know, people want to do this work together and learn from each other. And it's also an opportunity to pool your resources in order to maybe go bigger with a few organizations in collaboration with others rather than, you know, just having your own resources. So people, I think, get a lot out of that. They learn from each other and they find this same kind of sense of, you know, community that people find in a book club, but which is also wonderful. But in this case, they're spending their time and energy actually trying to, you know, do some good in their communities or on issues that they care about. And you know, the reality is that as an individual donor or even as a very, very large donor, you know, you don't accomplish anything alone. So even among some of the biggest foundations in the world, we see alliances where funders come together and say, you know, let's work on these issues in collaboration. And that's been the case in most of the great success stories of philanthropy. For example, a recent one was a number of donors and foundations that came together to support the marriage equality movement, you know, over the last decade and a half. And rather than acting independently, they pooled $153 million in a collaborative and supported the efforts to pursue, you know, policy change that ultimately culminated in the Supreme Court decision on marriage equality. And they recognized that, you know, you can really only accomplish something significant on big issues working in alliance with a lot of different other players.
This book is aimed at givers and would-be givers, but it seems like there's a lot that the nonprofits themselves might learn from understanding the philosophy of why people give and why they would want to give in a particular way.
Yeah, I hope so. And I also hope that nonprofit leaders find it useful as something that they can share with their boards, because I see a dynamic play out all the time at nonprofits where the boards may be comprised more of folks who come from a business background and don't necessarily have a grounding in the nonprofit sector or philanthropy. And then there can be a kind of difficult dynamic between the staff and the business folks on the board because they're not really speaking the same language. And I hope that the book, you know, can be a resource that nonprofits can use in helping educate also their donors and their boards so that there is a little bit more of a shared appreciation for why this work is both uniquely challenging and uniquely important.
Let me just say, Phil Buchanan, it is really fascinating reading. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me on to talk about it. I appreciate the opportunity.
Phil Buchanan is the founding chief executive of the Center for Effective Philanthropy and author of the new book called Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. He lives in Massachusetts, but we reached him by phone in California.
We'll take a short break now, and then it's a conversation with a Lake Effect contributor about how climate change is related to Wisconsin agriculture. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM.
With more of Lake Effect, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Whether it's snow at the end of April or an unusually warm January, climate change is on many of our minds. And while the change is having an impact on the things that grow here, the agriculture industry itself has an effect on the climate. The work of commercial growers emits as much as a quarter of the greenhouse gases released into the atmosphere.
And the journal Environmental Science and Technology reports the average American family's food consumption, whether it's burgers or potatoes, produces about 8 tons of carbon dioxide a year. Every step of the process of growing and distributing food has an impact.
But Lake Effect Farming contributor Dave Kozlowski, who co-owns Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek, says changing the way we eat can have a real impact. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio this month to explain how small changes in our food consumption can help the earth.
Anything we grow and process and transport is going to provide greenhouse gases. It doesn't matter whether it's a carrot or a quarter pounder. So there's some climate change impact in food production, period. But livestock certainly can own the largest percentage of that. It is everything from all the product that has to be transported and fed to feedlot animals, to the what is referred to as the burp and fart problem with the animals, principally burping, they burp up methane gas largely. And methane gas is a very potent greenhouse gas, 30 times more potent than CO2. So a small amount can go a long ways. And there are millions of animals at any one time in the day burping. So it's producing quite a bit. So livestock, particularly cattle, are big producers of greenhouse gases. And the interesting thing about that, at least to me, is that I just always assumed it would be conventionally grown beef in feedlots that were the problem. And if we just got rid of them and we put all these animals on grass, that we would solve the problem. As it turns out, much to my dismay, that's not, according to the studies I've seen, not quite the case. It is true that feedlot beef does produce a large percent of greenhouse gases. There's no getting away from that. But depending on how animals are raised on the grass will determine how much greenhouse gases they actually will emit. Whether it's corn they're eating or grass, the cows are still going to have intestinal problems. And there's still manure being spread. But the only way to really ameliorate that problem, and you're really not going to reduce the burping and the other thing, is to put fewer cows on more grass. Therefore, then the grass becomes a carbon sink. So there is a solution to that. And the way to do it, the way to begin, is eating less meat.
Yeah, on average, how much meat are Americans in particular consuming?
Well, the USDA suggests that we should be eating about 26 ounces a week. And the latest statistics I saw is we are consuming about 0.6 pounds a day. So a lot more meat than we need to be eating nutritionally and a lot more meat than we should be eating environmentally. And reducing the meat we eat can go a long ways. I mean, if we just cut down, well, let me put it this way. A way of sort of thinking about this is the average family food consumption contributes about 8 tons of CO2 per year. So what's a ton of CO2? A ton of CO2, if you can imagine this, is a cube 27 feet by 27 feet by 27 feet filled with CO2. Another way is a balloon 30 feet in diameter. That's what a ton of CO2 looks like. So if we think of a car with an average mile per gallon rating of 25 miles per gallon, traveling 12,000 miles a year, that car produces about 4.4 tons of CO2 on an annual basis. If we decide to go one day with no red meat, still consuming some chicken and some fish, if we decide to go one day with no red meat, you're basically lopping 760 miles off that annual basis. So you can see you're making a dent already in the CO2. If you go to an all-local diet, that is, you're consuming all your food only within, the studies didn't dictate what a local diet meant, but it would lop about the same thing, a little more, about 1,000 miles off the amount. So you're reducing a little bit of the greenhouse gases just by cutting out meat one day a week. And you're reducing a little bit by trying to buy more of your product, fruits, vegetables, et cetera, on a local basis. So are we going to turn back the clock on global climate change because you're eating less meat and buying locally? No. But, you know, it's the Chinese proverb, a thousand-mile journey begins with the first step. So at least if we start making some effort, then the public is also becoming involved in the issue of turning around climate change. And perhaps then it will be easier to make the big steps, the big things that have to get done.
Right, because some people may see their changing habits as drastic if, you know, we were to suggest don't eat meat anymore, everyone go vegan right now and only buy produce from your local farms. But, you know, say to lessen that drastic change, as you said, just once a week of no meats would help a lot. But would you say, you know, it's hard to define local, but would you say it's relatively an easier process for people to find things that are at least Wisconsin made?
I think so. Because you have to take in consideration that, talking about a little bit earlier, packaging and transportation aren't enormous contributors of greenhouse gases. of product. I mean, cars are a big contributor, but just trucking things back and forth do contribute a significant amount, but it's not huge. It's the raising of these animals and the raising of the product that costs more. So,
and it wouldn't necessarily be big machinery that's used on these this farms and cattle ranches per se. You know?
Right. If you're thinking of being perhaps smaller farms, they may or may not have a lesser impact on greenhouse gases. But at least on a smaller farm, you've got the community around it has a little more control over what's happening there, as opposed to an owner of 10,000 acres in Iowa that's growing corn. You know, the community really has no impact on that farmer. So buying locally, Midwest, you know, perhaps could have an impact. And when we were talking about meat, we're really talking about, in the studies, they were just talking about one day a week cutting out any red meat. So they weren't saying, you know, you have to go completely vegan that day. It would help, but you don't have to.
Yeah, so still plenty of fowl options or fish and things like that. Yeah. One thing that I'm curious about, would you say we have regional food production in the United States as well? Because Midwest, you could call us the corn belts, soybean farms. California is known for certain types of produce that's being shipped all over the country and the world. So when it comes to diversifying our land once again, do you think that's possible? Or are we at such a stage in, you know, big agriculture that reintroducing certain crops to areas that have been one or two things for most of their modern life, you know, would that help in the long run and then help people be able to shop more locally if there's diversified crops?
If we start cutting back in the amount of meat we eat, then we can start cutting back in the amount of corn and soybean we grow. Now, I will get trouble about saying that from some farmers because you're cutting out my livelihood. Well, that's not the intent here. The intent is to break up maybe some of these 10,000-acre farms and have them start growing regional fruits and vegetables. That's entirely possible. And then we're not having to move it from California, which, again, transportation does have an impact on the climate. And California is going to have its own problems. Under a climate change scenario, California should get drier than it is even now. And the Southeast is going to get hotter than it is now. So we're not going to be able to move as much from there. And certainly creating a regional, local market for our food, whether it be meat or produce, is certainly doable. And it doesn't mean like reinventing anything. It just means a reuse of the land. Iowa State, the University of Iowa State, not exactly a bastion of liberalism. It's an ag school. Did a study. And they found that Iowa could become self-sufficient in 28 popular fruits and vegetables by just utilizing a county or two in that state and converting it to produce. So Wisconsin could do the same, Minnesota could do the same, Illinois could do the same, Indiana, Ohio, et cetera, et cetera. There are some states that might struggle with that, but that's okay. We'll produce enough and we'll ship it to them.
Now, on the note of shipping, one of the things that is very popular nowadays are the meal kits, and those, of course, are shipped to your homes. A lot of people see the packaging as very wasteful, and they may think that that is a big contributor to more carbon emissions, more energy, food waste, product waste of those things coming to your door for, a dinner, you know, not necessarily a week's worth of supplies, you know, for example, like CSAs. But a new study published on Monday in the scientific journal Resources, Conservation, and Recycling, they took a look at the whole life cycle, so from farm to garbage can, of meal kits. And surprisingly, at least to my surprise, they find that meal kits and their grocery store equivalents, on average, store meals are producing 33% more greenhouse gas emissions than things and meal kits from companies such as, say, Blue Apron. You know, do you find that interesting?
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I am a small produce grower,
yes.
So I am I do have my problem with meal kits, but they're right. The more you can reduce waste, the more you're going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions because the less things we have to grow and ship, right? I mean, currently, the U.S. wastes about 61 million tons of food a year. That's 31% of the annual supply. Well, if we can cut into that annual supply that's being wasted, it's less that we're having to grow and less greenhouse gases are having to emit. And if it takes meal kits, ooh, to do it, well,
it sounds reluctant.
You know, we all have to sacrifice. So, yeah, it's a good point. To me, the point is don't waste. Mm-hmm. Restaurants shouldn't be wasting. Grocery stores shouldn't be wasting. That's what we have to do.
And when it comes to the bottom line, you know, we have eat less meat, eat closer to home, eat more fruits and vegetables. You know, are there any things that you would suggest that changing our diet or including in that change of diet to take it one step further? Because, you know, as you mentioned, we see greenhouse gas emissions and climate change as this big behemoth of an issue. But with small little steps, can people just be a little more mindful of, say, how much heads of broccoli they're buying, that, okay, on average, how much am I throwing out at the end of the week because it's gotten rotten?
Right, right. Really, the takeaway here is if you can, reduce the amount of meat you're eating, particularly red meat. If you can, try to buy, and again, in an interest of full disclosure, I don't want to be self-serving here, but do try to find produce and even your meat as close to your home as possible. And then buy what you know you're going to use or preserve it, because a lot of what you buy during season can be canned or frozen or dried, and it's not a hard process, so then you're not wasting it. You're saving it for a time when you can't get that fresh produce.
What do you think with the packaging of produce to grocery stores in the first place? You know, things such as Aldi, they're packaging 3 red bell peppers in their own plastic bag, Brussels sprouts, saran wrap, things like that. How does that change come about when it comes to packaging food for wide distribution and sale?
Yeah, well, I don't have the studies in front of me about how much packaging actually contributes to the greenhouse gases, so it's a little bit difficult for me to say for sure. But just taking the meal kit example, if you're packaging something in smaller quantities and you know people are going to use that rather than taking it home and letting the potatoes sprout or the peppers rot because they thought they were going to use 3 pounds of it and they ended up not using that, well, then it's a good thing because you're at least not wasting it. But we, as a society, we have to go the next step back. Should the grocery store be buying all this just to fill their shelves up, knowing full well that in 2 weeks it's all going to get tossed into the dumpster? You know, that's the next step. We have to reach the middleman, if you will, in that process. Consumers can only do so much about the waste, and then it comes down to, you know, the restaurants and grocery stores and processing facilities. You know, a lot of things are harvested and taken to facilities where they're bagged, weighed, canned, whatever. And if it doesn't meet society's ideal image for a product that, you know, we have this one image of what an apple or a pepper looks like, they will toss it. And sometimes they find uses for it, but a lot of times it just becomes waste. So that 31% of annual waste is also on the processing side.
So we just need to be less picky.
We need to be less picky.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the other end of eating less meat, more fruits and vegetables, obviously, you would hope we would also start feeling better.
That's the real win-win thing here. Right, right. So what we're saying, trying in reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the food that you're consuming, you're also making yourself healthier. And if you're buying locally, and particularly if you're buying organically, you're helping the environment and it's being healthier. So there's just not a good reason for the current American diet. It really is not. It isn't good for you healthy-wise. It isn't good for the environment. It isn't good for climate change. So let's start making a few changes. Let's start a little bit at a time each week to eliminate this. Have a meatless Friday. We just passed Lent, too bad,
yeah.
But institute that, you know, year-round.
Do you think it'll be a struggle to do that, or are you optimistic about changing people's habits? I feel like especially meat eating is, you know, this is American way of life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to have, you know, my steak or my burgers or whichever else.
And yeah, there's a lot of wrapped into that. There's the cultural aspects of, you know, I was raised eating a lot of meat. Mm-hmm. I'm a meat and potatoes kind of guy.
Marketing,
blah, blah, blah.
Of restaurants, everything.
Marketing, restaurants, right. You go to a restaurant, you'll get a big, you know, 6 ounces of something and then, or 8 ounces of something and then a little sprinkle of vegetables on the side. It's going to be a cultural change. And I don't expect restaurants to lead that. I expect it to the homeowner to, in their daily meals or weekly meals, to change some of that. But it's cultural issues you have to get over. It's, you know, people, diet issues, people think high protein diets are really good for them. Well, in point of fact, they're not. So you have to get past that sort of myth. I am hopeful. To tell you the truth, I am hopeful. You know, even from a cost-cutting perspective, proteins, animal proteins tend to be more expensive than produce. So everybody should be looking into cutting some of their budgets.
Exactly. All right. Well, Dave, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Lake Effect contributor Dave Kozlowski and his wife Sandy Rodens co-own Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek. Kozlowski is a regular Lake Effect contributor, and you can listen to our past farming segments with him at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then veteran police sergeant and former Milwaukeean Adam Plantinga shares what he's learned about crime, community, and violence in a new book. He gives us a taste when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. There are many things police officers need to know. How to deal with drunk drivers, when to chase a perp, or when to use force. Author and former Milwaukee police officer Adam Plantinga covers many of these things in his first book, 400 Things Cops Know.
Plantinga is now a police sergeant with the San Francisco Police Department, and he's authored a new book titled Policecraft: What Cops Know About Crime, Community, and Violence. The book details some of Plantinga's personal experiences with these issues and how they've shaped his work. Where his first effort was kind of an extended list, this latest book features much more extended essays. And I asked him whether writing that way was a freeing experience.
Yeah, I think it was. You know, police work is a pretty rich and varied field, so I had more to say. But I also wanted to get away a little bit from the bullet point format of the first book and just sort of unpack a few controversies or sort of points of interest in police work, and this gave me a little more room to do so.
Right. I wondered if 400 Things Cops Know didn't sort of get your head going and make you want to kind of flesh some of these things out more that you maybe touched on in the more, you know, listicle format of the previous one.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few sort of big flash points, race, use of force, community policing, that I just wanted to get in a little bit more. And I mean, those are all topics that I think deserve further exploration.
Well, I want to talk about some of them here in just a minute, but I want to actually ask you sort of in a way of framing this whole conversation, what is the difference that you see? And you're right about this. What's the difference you see between being a cop and being a police officer?
Well, being a police officer, you are basically taking the assignments that the dispatcher gives you. Maybe you do an occasional traffic stop. You do what the job requires you to do, sort of no more and no less. And those folks are solid and steady, and they're the backbone of any police department. But cops sort of make a distinction. If you're a cop, you tend to sort of dig a little deeper. You're a little nosier. You probably have a better understanding of who the regular crooks are in your district and what they're up to and what their names are and their street names and what they drive and where they hang out. If a description of an armed robber comes out of the air and it's fairly distinctive, you may already know who that person is. I think cops are just more sort of plugged in and in tune to the street, and that's why they're so valuable.
Would you want the public at large to make that distinction in their head between a cop and a police officer, or is it more a sense for if you're practicing the profession, you need to have that understanding?
I think it's more for us who are practicing the profession. You know, if you call the police, a police officer will give you, you know, steady and competent service. So it may be a distinction that's not so important for the public.
So there is a section of this book on police-community relations, and it's in that section that you relate the story of your time as a Milwaukee cop when you lived right in the middle of the area you were serving. What did that time teach you about how cops are perceived in the communities where they're working?
Well, it was a bit of an urban experiment. I lived in a pretty high-crime, low-income neighborhood, which was fairly easy for me to do because at the time I was single with no kids. And I went into it with sort of the best of intentions. I wanted to be sort of a stabilizing force, maybe troubleshoot a few neighborhood problems. But my time there taught me that I was pretty naive. I ran afoul of the crack house across the street. There were armed robberies in the neighborhood where I was going to and from my car with my hand on my gun. It was a time of real unrest, sort of hard to come home and unwind. And everyone in the neighborhood knew I was an officer, and they'd come to me with problems, both large and small. But the problem was I wasn't on duty, so I was trying to kind of do the best I can, but I would find myself trying to handle neighborhood problems by myself out of uniform that I never would have dreamed of handling even as a uniform cop with the tools on my tool belt and a radio. So I think it taught me to have sort of more realistic expectations about what an officer can do in one neighborhood. And I know there are cops that live in depressed areas and do well, but that's a lot to ask. It's nice to have some separation between work and home life.
Well, and I wonder if there's, you know, this vision that a lot of us have, this kind of, I don't know if utopian is the right word, but, you know, we kind of imagine, you know, the neighborhood police officer just being another part of the community along with a doctor and the, you know, the pharmacist and the whatever. But that's like a model that really doesn't exist in most American communities anymore.
Well, and I think it predominantly in sort of lower income neighborhoods that are high crime, there's not a whole lot that one officer can do. I mean, they could be a good witness, but they're not going to go out there and right all the neighborhood wrongs. That's not, I don't think, a realistic expectation.
Is there something, though, at the heart of it about the idea of investment in a community for the people who are there to protect it?
I mean, I do. I think if you look at it sort of philosophically, it's, I mean, that's what you want. I mean, you want cops to be sort of stakeholders and to have an investment in the neighborhoods that they're in. And a lot of officers do live in the city that they patrol, but they tend to live not so much in sort of the lower income neighborhoods where they might run into someone at the grocery store that they, you know, that they arrested the previous night or got in a fight with. That can be a little tough, especially if cops have families. They want their families to be safe.
There's another section of the book called The Corner, and of course it is hard to think of that term without conjuring David Simon's book of the same name. But he did the reporting for that book, what, 25 years ago at least, I think. What's the significance of The Corner to cops today?
Well, every sort of major metropolitan area has a corner, and it's usually an area that's fairly depressed, sort of a high concentration of street-level drug activity and liquor stores. And transients, probably a lot of housing where maybe parolees or people that just got out of jail are. And it's sort of this mishmash where there's crime and sort of urban despair and a little bit of street theater. It all gets kind of mixed together. And it's sort of ground zero for police work. That's where you go to sort of test your mettle. That's where you go to sort of figure out what you're made of, because that's where the action is.
It's almost a romantic picture in the, you know, the, I don't know whether that's the capital R or the lowercase R way, but, you know, it's just it seems to have a touch on so many different aspects of police work.
Yeah, it really does. When you go to the corner, you have sort of a front row seat to problems of immigration, of homelessness, of mental illness. It's where all those things sort of mix together.
You quote your dad, who I gather was a minister and theologian, in the part of this book about the law. We hear a lot about justice projects that have exonerated innocent people wrongly convicted of crimes, but we don't often hear from the police whose work is called into question. What was it your father said in the convocation that you quote, and how does it shape your view of the subject?
Well, my dad, who is one of the best men I know, talked about people who were wrongly convicted and what the reaction of, say, a district attorney or an officer who were involved in that case should be. And his point was that it should be cause for a great sorrow because you had committed yourself to a mission that turned out to be wrong. And an innocent man did time as a result of that. And now no one can give back to him the years that were stolen from him. And I think that sometimes officers can get a little jaded about such things. They may think, well, if someone was wrongly convicted for this, they probably did something else that they were never caught for, so everything sort of evens out. But that's not how the law works. That's not how justice works. If this person did not commit this crime and they were convicted for it, then that's a grievous wrong, and we should all be saddened by that.
You also quote quite a lot through this book your former partner in Milwaukee, Rolf Mueller.
Rolf Mueller, yeah.
Yeah, Rolf Mueller. You quote him a lot. Aside from the names of police chiefs and some officers, you know, who are unfortunately caught up in legal issues, we don't often hear or remember the names of police officers. So why is Rolf Mueller a name we should know?
Well, Rolf was an old school cop. He's a battle axe of a guy, just very tough, very dedicated. He went his last maybe 22, 23 years without calling in sick. And he was someone who did the job right. He would go after criminals vigorously. But if there was, say, a woman that had her window broken out, he'd go get a broom and a dustpan and sweep up her glass without being asked. He really sort of exemplified the community servant. There was a time when Rolf was brutally beaten up by a suspect who he was trying to arrest off duty. And Rolf saw this same suspect sometime later when he was in uniform. And for some cops, that would have been an opportunity for payback. But Rolf treated him respectfully like any other person he'd come into contact with. And that's very hard to do. He did the job right.
Well, and how much of doing the job right in that model can be taught versus being, you know, something that is inherently a part of a person before he or she, you know, goes through the police academy?
Right. Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of it is sort of internalized. A lot of it is what you bring to the table. But ideally, the people that the department sends to train you, whether it be a field training officer or a sergeant, are people that do the job right. So you have good role models and they're right in front of you. So those are people you can emulate and sort of figure out the right way to do the job. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to work.
Your job now in San Francisco is sergeant. How do you stay current or relevant as a sergeant versus being, you know, the kind of line officer that, you know, you write so many experiences about?
Right. Well, the one of the benefits I have now is I am back on street patrol. So I get to get into the mix a little bit. I respond to the big calls, the shootings, the stabbings, the bad car accidents. And I may not be the first one to go hands-on because I have to take a little step back. But being a street sergeant lets you sort of keep your skills up because sometimes you are arresting people, chasing people, kicking down doors. You just don't do those things quite as often as a street cop. Although I'm 45 now, so when I am chasing, fighting, kicking down doors, I do it all a lot slower now, and it sort of hurts more the next day.
So this is your second book. You have gotten some nice attention from the Wall Street Journal. You were quoted not long ago on NPR in a story they were doing. You must be getting a certain amount of notoriety among your colleagues and maybe on the streets as well.
Yeah, a lot of my colleagues are aware of the books, but they've been pretty kind. Some of them have bought the book and asked me to sign it, which I get a kick out of. But, you know, cops being cops, they like to get some jabs in. So not long ago, I was driving a police vehicle and I forgot to roll the windows up when it started raining. So one of my coworkers came over the air and said, "Hey, rolling up the windows when it rains, isn't that supposed to be one of the 400 things cops know?" And I thought, you know what? That's pretty fair.
Do I remember, is there a story about the photo shoot that you did for the Wall Street Journal as well?
Yeah, I was doing a photo shoot on the unit block of 6th Street, which is in San Francisco, which is really essentially the corner, sort of a high crime area. And one of the drug dealers that I had frequently arrested happened to be around during this photo shoot, and he took some interest in that, so he just photobombed the heck out of it. There's a number of pictures of him in the background throwing up hand signs, and my wife got a big kick out of it. She wanted to include one of those photos on her family Christmas card.
Did you at least give him an autographed copy of the book?
You know, I haven't seen him in a while. I think he may be in prison, but if I see him again, we'll have that conversation.
He might have some time on his hands to read it anyway.
Yes, I think that's very possible.
Well, so I should ask, is there a thought of a third book down the road?
Well, I think that if I read a third book, I may try my hand at fiction. Not that police work, it's such a rich field that could certainly sustain a third book, but I feel like I've sort of said what I wanted to say, and you know, maybe it's someone else's turn now. But, you know, I love writing. I have the writing bug, so I feel like I'll continue that in one capacity or another.
Adam Planiga is a former Milwaukee police officer. He's currently a police sergeant with the San Francisco Police Department.
Planiga has authored two books on policing, including his latest book titled Policecraft: What Cops Know About Crime, Community, and Violence. Our interview first aired in March. We have time for a poem on today's show. We spoke with Milwaukee poet Steven Anderson last week about his new collection of poetry. He read some additional poems for us, and here's one of them now.
This poem is called A Stone's Throw from Store Bay, and it's bay. Store Bay is an actual bay that is in the island of Tobago, which is a sister island republic, two-island republic, Trinidad and Tobago. And so the focus is there. It's an idyllic island, almost totally unspoiled by being over-touristed. There are very few hotels on it. It's a very kind of private and enjoyable spot. It's called A Stone's Throw from Store Bay. At a seaside cafe in Tobago, the drummers enter and drum, one by one at first, then pick up as a group, their percussion, along with an impromptu conch shell riff, vibrates the night air, rattles glasses containing iced rum punches and beer, sets bats on night fright flying patterns out over the beach to the sea's edge. This is man's mark on the night. A momentary occupation of what nature really owns. A temporal heist of misunderstood magnitude, now as bass and tenor, congo, bongo, and side drum, along with the conch shell, take center stage for this brief interlude again, only to dissolve into performance art, nothingness, after the drums are packed up and lugged back home, leaving only vague, soon forgotten echoes in the captive listeners there. The bats quickly swoop back in to retake their habitat in search of the succulent buzzing mosquitoes there, plump with the blood from the tourists whose evening will turn itchy at best.
Milwaukee poet Steven Anderson reading A Stone's Throw from Store Bay. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.